Hello and welcome to IPO Stories, a podcast that explores the tracks to IPOs for companies and their stakeholders.
Through interviews with professionals who have led companies to public markets, we will learn about what it takes to IPO a business, the do's and the don'ts before, during, and after a listing process. I'm Gauthier.
I'm Per, co-founders of Omniscient Investment Management, a Europe-based equity manager. In 2018, Spotify was the first company to do a direct listing instead of a regular IPO process, foregoing the usual book-building process in favor of opening the shares directly on the market in an auction. In 2021, Wise also did a direct listing in the UK, and we recently hosted Matt Briers, the CFO of Wise, to share his experience. Dakin Campbell is the author of the book Going Public, where he recounts the history and the inside stories of some of the major IPOs in recent memory, starting with the 1956 IPO of Ford, focusing on the innovations that have occurred through time, such as the 2004 Google IPO, the 2012 Facebook IPO, and the direct listings in recent years. With Dakin, we discuss what led Spotify and others to prefer a direct listing transaction and some of the pros and cons of a direct listing versus a traditional IPO. Before we start, we would like to remind our listeners that our discussion is not financial advice, nor an investment recommendation, nor a solicitation to buy or sell any financial instruments or an offer for financial services or any other transaction. The information contained in the recording has no contractual value and are destined for an informational purpose only. Omniscient Investment Management and the participants in this podcast may have holdings in the companies being discussed. Dakin, thank you very much for joining us today. Maybe you can start by introducing yourself.
Yeah, I'm a chief correspondent on Insider's investigations team. For many years, I covered Wall Street and was the chief finance correspondent at Insider. I spent 10 years at Bloomberg News before that.
And you wrote this book about IPOs, Going Public. What actually led you to write this book about IPOs?
It's a good question, one that I ask myself sometimes. Still, you know, I've been covering Wall Street since the global financial crisis. And so I'd always sort of known about the IPO market. I talked to bankers and investors who worked in that market, but I never really took a deep dive into that market. And it was the summer of 2019, and WeWork, as the most valuable private company at the time, was gearing up for their IPO. And there was so much hype that my editors came to me and said, hey, I know you haven't been covering WeWork, but you know, bankers and investors, why don't you pitch in here? And over the course of that summer and fall, we all know what happened. I mean, WeWork collapsed. And it just felt to me, looking from the outside in, that this was a company that was not served well by the process. They had their own idiosyncrasies with their founder and all of those things that we all know, but it also seemed like their bankers were not serving them as well as they could have. And so that was sort of the first time that I got a real deep interest in the IPO market and wondering, how does this work? And what are the norms here? And what are these processes that sort of left this company, you know, out to dry? And so I wrote a feature story that got the attention of a book agent, and he said, do you want to write about WeWork? And I said, no, I don't, but I'm really interested in this IPO process. It's interesting. I love going down the rabbit hole of specific submarkets. And so let me write a book about this. And so that was the beginning of the book process.
So in the book, you go back basically on the history of the IPO before then going into the innovations that we've seen over the last 5 years. And one quite vivid description in the book is about the IPO of Ford in 1956, which involved 722 investment banks to raise $658 million, right? But if you take the broad strokes, how has the IPO process actually evolved since then? What's been the changes?
So I really thought it was important for me to look at the history to really understanding, you know, to understand today. And I mean, you mentioned it in the, you know, 722 underwriters. And I think there were, once you count other retail brokerages, there were a couple thousand firms on that deal. And obviously it doesn't work like that anymore. You know, maybe you'll get 10 banks or underwriters on a deal. And really it comes down to only one or two that are running the deal at any one time. So you've had a real consolidation in terms of the underwriters and the brokerages that are participating in IPOs. And you've also seen quite a bit of changes in how they're marketed and how they're carried out. So in the Ford days, because there were so many firms, the underwriters and the brokers were really marketing themselves to mom and pop investors. You know, it was going out on Main Street and selling 100 shares at a time to wealthy businessmen, lawyers, doctors, folks like that. In the mid-80s, Goldman Sachs came along and really professionalized, I guess it would be a way to put it, the marketing of these companies and really started selling them into big mutual fund. You know, at that point in time, T. Rowe Price and Fidelity and others were really beginning to amass the assets under management that they now have. And so Goldman figured out how to really market and really tell the stories of these companies to professional investors.
And as I said, Goldman established a model that roughly exists in form and function today, quoting from your book, right? It hasn't changed that much, actually.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, if any of your listeners, you know, work on equity capital markets desks or are aware of them, many of them are, there were no equity capital markets desks before Goldman created it in like the mid-1980s. So that whole market, if folks know how that works now with syndication and equity capital market selling and things like that, that was all sort of established by Goldman. And then nothing really changed. That was a big change in the mid to late 80s. And then nothing has really changed or nothing really changed until I make the case the sort of direct listing wave kicked off in 2018.
You have the Google IPO in 2004 that stands to me as one of the most significant innovations. You have a Dutch auction that was specifically designed to extract the highest possible price from the IPO. Can you tell us the story about how and why Google designed this process?
Yeah. And it's important to recognize the context of the time that Google was coming public. It was 2003. Their IPO finally happened in the summer of 2004, and that was right after the first dot-com crash. There were a number of government investigations into, you know, investment banking, spinning, and other things like that. Really, people thought that this was a little bit of a corrupt market. And so Google, who had been selling their ads online by that point already for several years, thought to themselves, if we can auction off ads, then why can't we auction off our shares? And if we can auction off our shares ourselves, why do we even need any of these bankers, you know, some of whom are being investigated by the SEC or Department of Justice? And so that was really the beginning of Google's Dutch auction. And a bunch of them started meeting at a Denny's restaurant around the corner from Google's headquarters and really started piecing together, really creating almost out of whole cloth, a new way of selling shares.
I think Eric Schmidt, you know, telling your book that he sat down with the Credit Suisse investment banker saying, can you tell me by how much the demand for IPOs is overstated? With the investment banker answering, well, they're 20 times oversubscribed because people ask for 10% of the deal, but they don't really want 10%. They just ask for that because they want less.
That's right. I love those scenes from the book because it just shows how early Google was to sort of understanding how the regular IPO, the traditional IPO market worked, and how there were these sort of built-in conflicts. And so, you know, another scene is Morgan Stanley bankers up at a whiteboard telling Eric Schmidt how the auction was going to go, and this is how investors want to see it. And Eric Schmidt saying, well, no, this is our deal, and this is how we're going to do it. And just basically taking a red marker and crossing off each thing that the Morgan Stanley bankers suggested. And so the real challenges, though, that came with creating a new process is really what ended up dooming the Google Dutch auction. I mean, they initially tried to sell shares at $132, and they had to bring it all the way down to $85 before they sold the shares they wanted to sell. And so, you know, they fought with the SEC on a number of things. They angered institutional investors who thought that they were, you know, arrogant or not sort of speaking to them enough. There are a whole sort of host of things that Google did that really didn't help them or help their deal succeed. But, you know, you talk to the folks at Google, they'll say, okay, we sold it at 85 and the shares never went below, haven't gone below 85 since. They traded up to 100 the day after and they kept going. So, you know, some of it, and I make this point in the book, some of it, it was sort of opponents of Google or established players in the traditional IPO market really didn't want Google to try to create something new. And so they seized on the fact that the company had to lower its price and really pitch the narrative that this was a failed offering and a failed transaction. And, you know, to their credit, that narrative really took hold. I mean, going into Google's deal, a lot of people thought that if they could be successful, it was going to unleash a whole wave of other Dutch auctions from copycats, and that this would finally become the time that, you know, the Goldman model of the mid-1980s was finally changed in favor of issuers and in favor of companies that really wanted to design their transaction to meet their needs. Because the transaction didn't go so well, you know, folks spun it as a failure, and then that narrative really took hold over the next several years.
And almost even a decade, right? Because I think the next major innovation was basically, as you're saying, Spotify coming to the market in 2018, which is 14 years later.
That's right.
With a direct listing. So Spotify being a Swedish company, listing in the US, venture capital backed, but choosing to go a very different route from what people had done before, even from Google, right? Can you tell us a bit about how that idea came about and why Spotify chose to go that way?
Yeah. So in the intervening 14 years between Google and Spotify, you know, we first, the term unicorn was coined. There was a ton of money available in the private markets, and all of these sort of high, you know, fast growing tech companies could really get as much money as they wanted before the IPO process. And so Spotify was no different. And so by 2016, 2017, they had $1 billion or more in the bank. And so they didn't need to go to the market to raise capital, but they did need to get their shares publicly traded because employees wanted an easier way to sell their shares. And executives really wanted liquidity for those shares for M&A transactions and for other things. So the CFO at the time, Barry McCarthy, set out to figure out how can Spotify get public without raising new capital, without selling new shares. That sort of led him on this 18-month journey to figure out what he could do or if he could do it a different way. And McCarthy, I think, is a really interesting figure in this because he had spent, you know, over 10 years at Netflix. He was the guy who really figured out how to fund the streaming model that Netflix pioneered. And so he was in constant contact with the market and with investors and understanding sort of what investors wanted to see and understanding like how he could raise money. I don't know that there's at the time that there was a CFO better or more familiar with how the capital markets worked. And so he set out to figure out what else they could do. And he settled on this direct listing model, which had been done before. I mean, when companies go into bankruptcy, for example, and they come out of bankruptcy, their shares are directly listed onto the exchange. When you've also got spin outs, some of the spun out companies sometimes just list its shares onto the exchange. So there was a model, but that model had never been applied to tech companies, to unicorns.
And to unknown companies to the market, basically, where you still had to do some investor education before becoming listed, right?
Yes, exactly. That's a great point. And perhaps critically, the SEC was not used to or had never sort of overseen this process of bringing unknown companies into the market by directly listing them. And so a big part of what McCarthy and Spotify pulled off was really convincing the SEC that this model that had been used for more well-known companies or companies coming out of bankruptcy could actually be used to sell shares of companies, unknown high growth companies. That was a real innovation.
It seems like if we tell the story of innovation here, the big innovations have actually come through subsequently almost larger IPOs, right? It's larger and larger companies through Ford, Google, Facebook, Spotify, kind of these very large tech companies. But then, of course, for the smaller companies, and we have Criteo, for example, a French company listed in the US with a $2 billion valuation in 2013. The roadshow and the excitement around the IPO is also very important, right? Because to get the transaction done, they actually need to get investor interest. I guess when we talk about Spotify, it's a company that everybody knew about. There were already a lot of different investors. So it's a slightly different situation.
Yes. I mean, the big difference between a traditional IPO and a direct listing is in a traditional IPO, you're paying your bankers, your underwriters to market your company and your company story. In a direct listing, the bankers aren't allowed to play that role. And so you as a company have to do it. And so if you're starting as an unknown company, going out there and marketing yourself to the market, that's a much steeper hill that you've got to climb to generate the interest that you need to sell your shares. Whereas companies like Spotify, companies like Google, they're known, they're well known already. And so it's not quite so hard to tell your story. I mean, Spotify, as an example, they held an investor day before the direct listing in downtown Manhattan, and it was an event. I mean, more people wanted to get into it than they had seats. It was super exclusive, and there was already buzz around it at that time. You know, some less known company, if they were to try to do the same thing, they might have a much harder time trying to fill the seats.
Apart from this responsibility for investor marketing falling on the company rather than the bankers and advisors, what are some of the other main differences between the direct listing and the traditional IPO?
So the big difference is the traditional IPO, many people might not realize, but is the night before the shares start trading. And that's a meeting that happens with the bankers and with the company selling the shares. And so it's in that meeting, actually, that the price of the shares are set and that the allocation is set. They determine which investors get how many shares. With a direct listing, that meeting doesn't happen. You basically go straight to the market the next day and list the shares, and you let the market set the price. And so a lot of purists like that, because we've had markets for hundreds of years. They're a very good mechanism for setting price, of bringing together supply and demand. And so proponents of the direct listing really feel like that is a preferable way of setting shares, of setting the price, than is a meeting attended by a few bankers who've had bespoke conversations with a bunch of investors sitting down with company management. That feels very human-driven and not like a fully functioning market. And so a lot of opponents of the traditional IPO model feel like that is not an effective way to set the price of the shares.
I think it also appeals to maybe tech founders. I like the description that Matt Briers gave us of the direct listing, where Christo Carmen, the founder of Wise, called it basically a config change. He said, well, before our shares were private and now they're public and there's nothing's changed about the company, but now there's a price that floats and that's the only change, which I guess makes sense for that company that already had like a very wide investor base.
Yes. And we've sort of alluded to it. It's worth noting, with a direct listing, you can't raise new money. So you're not selling new shares. You're just selling shares that you've already issued. So if you're a company that needs to raise money, you almost have to use the traditional IPO at this point.
Right. When I look at it, there's two features that stand out. One is the fact that the direct listing has a very flexible size, in the sense of compared to an IPO, where typically an IPO, first you decide how many shares you're going to sell, and then you find the price for it. But you typically don't really upsize it. And actually upsizing an IPO is usually a bad sign, because then we create more uncertainty about how many shares are in circulation. But the fact that you have this flexible size means that on the one hand, the IPO can actually grow in size as demand grows. So that's kind of good for the sellers. But then on the other side, it can actually also lead to a very small IPO, where sort of US IPOs have been going from becoming smaller and smaller parts of the company. But you could actually end up with a situation where you have less than 5% of the company actually changing hands, right? Because you didn't really find that agreement on price and there were very few willing sellers on the day of the direct listing. The other main change that I think appeals a lot to especially the VC funds is the fact that there's no lockup. So when the price is right, anybody can sell, employees and former shareholders, etc. And that in a way I think is very interesting, because it's a very good way for investors to get size. I think the IPO process has this issue where, yes, you constrain the size, you say you're not going to upsize, and basically there's a lockup of 6 months. So during that 6 month period, you could say that there is a mismatch in supply and demand. If you have a very large investor who wants to buy 5% of the company, is basically not possible, right? Or it's going to press up the price in a very non-fundamental manner. So in some way, you do actually have probably a more fair value price, a bit of time either at IPO or just after, and everybody's free to do what they want. So I think those two features are very interesting. As you're saying, that the lack of primary is probably a challenge to many growth companies, but can also be solved by other means. I think we have some examples of companies who have actually raised money in the process or just before the process.
Yeah. So what a lot of companies do is they'll raise a private round right before their direct listing. And then if they need more money, once they direct list, they'll do a follow-on offering 6 or 9 or 12 months down the line.
I want to talk a bit about the role of the investment banks, because you described the direct listing as originating in something of a conflict between Wall Street, so investment banks, and Silicon Valley, VC founders. But to me, in an IPO, yes, there is an important role of investment banks, but in the end, the issuer and the sellers are actually the decision makers. And we've seen that in sort of the examples of Google and Spotify, that banks have actually accepted variations of the process. So I'm just wondering, did you really think it's the case that the banks control the process so strongly that you need to change the process?
Yeah, so that was one of the big questions that I wanted to answer when I started out reporting this book. At the time I started writing it, direct listing, Spotify had already done their direct listing, and Slack had just done the second one. And the narrative was out there that this traditional IPO process was broken. It was an insider's game. It was really about the banks in that meeting the night before the shares start trading, really setting the price and, you know, forcing the issuer's hand. And so I really tried to take an open mind and get myself into those rooms and into those meetings the night before the shares started trading and report it out and figure out, like, is this really the bankers strong-arming issuers into taking a lower price, or is it the bankers really handing huge amounts of shares to their best clients? And the truth is that there's nuance there, which is perhaps not surprising, but I did come upon many anecdotes where the bankers really, they lead the process. That's why they're being hired by companies. And if you have company management teams that either don't care or they're not very sophisticated, then they do really hand over a good portion of the process and many key decisions to their bankers. And so I do think the bankers will never say specifically, like, you need to give this million shares to this hedge fund because they're our best client. But they are very good at making compelling cases for why that hedge fund should get a million shares, and for maybe why that hedge fund isn't going to sell all million shares the next day in the market when it pops, you know, 50% or something. So I do agree that it ultimately is the issuer's decision on allocation and price. But I think once you get in those meetings, you realize that the issuers are really outsourcing a lot of their decisions to the bankers. And so I do think that ends up giving the bankers quite a bit of influence in the process. I mean, you know, one example, you know, the way these things usually work is you get into that meeting, the bankers come to that meeting with the company the night before the shares start trading, the actual IPO, and they've got a spreadsheet with 400, 450 rows. And they say, you know, here are our allocations. We've been talking to investors for weeks. Here's who we think are really interested. And here's who we think should get your shares, and in the order. And management teams look at that spreadsheet, but very, very few of them spend the time to go down 450 rows on a spreadsheet. So they're looking at maybe the top 25. And they're saying, okay, Fidelity is getting 2.5 million shares. We like them a lot. Maybe we should give them 3 million. It's like, it's a little bit of horse trading, or not really horse trading, but shifting allocations at the top of the stack. But then it ends up being up to the banks to fill out, you know, the remaining 350 investors. And it's sort of left up to them in many cases to decide what allocations those investors get. And so that's just one example of, yes, it is the issuer, it is the company making the decision, but a lot of those allocation decisions end up going to the bank or being made by the bankers.
But it's interesting what you say about focusing on the top 25, right? Which is clearly the case in the US, case everywhere in terms of IPO allocations. And I like to see the IPO as a path for a company to build a diversified shareholder base, because you arrive at the IPO. And yes, I mean, Facebook probably had more than 500 investors, and the Jobs Act means you can actually go to 2,000 investors without becoming public. But most companies coming to an IPO have a handful. Maybe it's 5 to 10 large investors and then some employees. But when you become listed, your objective is actually to have thousands of investors a few years post-IPO. That's what's going to give you a liquid share price, is going to have some investors supporting you when you need to raise capital again, and have your price trade in line with fair value, which then sort of helps you actually raise money, right? But at the same time, the asset manager landscape globally has actually contracted. It's actually become more and more concentrated. So you have some very large investors, BlackRock, Capital, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, you mentioned them, that are high quality, but they're not just not that many in number. And so I'm just wondering, if is the direct listing a way to maybe address a wider shareholder base of more investors than you would normally be targeting in the regular IPO?
I think it absolutely is. When you're allocating shares in a traditional IPO, It's important to remember you're only allocating to institutional investors. So that cuts out all of retail, even wealthy retail who could take positions in numbers. And it's limiting the institutional investors to those who are known to the underwriters and those who are, you know, chosen by the underwriters and the issuers. So, you know, I talked to a lot of companies in the process of reporting out this book, and a lot of companies and a lot of investors. And some of the investors I talked to said, it's just not worth our time. If we're going to get 50 shares in this IPO, we're not going to do the work that it takes to analyze it. But if you could promise us 50,000 shares or 500,000 shares, then all of a sudden that's worth our time. And so some people, I think, have made the argument that you could go from, in that traditional IPO, you could go from allocating to 450 different investors. You could take that up to 200 investors. And that way you could get more asset managers, not hedge funds, asset managers involved and interested in the IPO because you could actually give them size in a way that makes them interested. That's one way to think about it. But then the direct listing, as we've talked about, is a mechanism to just open it up to the entire market at once. So if you are an investor and you don't have a great relationship with Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, you can still, you know, back up the truck and get your allocation and get the position that you want to get much quicker than you can with any companies that go through a traditional IPO. Plus, a direct listing also includes retail and other folks who are necessarily locked out of the traditional IPO process. So it really does come down to the direct listing is a market. It's a full market. If you want to buy those shares in size, you can do it on day one if you want. And what better way to really come up with a price than to, you know, make the entire world's investors give them access to this company's shares on day one?
I think there's a distinction to be made between US IPOs and maybe rest of world IPOs. I think US IPOs have tended to be very small in terms of the company, so difficult to get shares for a lot of investors, even though they're interested, but also sort of performing very well. So obviously very attractive if you get allocations. So it seems to me like the direct listing, at least in the US, does put more importance and responsibility on the fund manager to do their own research and figure out what their actual price sensitivity is, which we're already doing all the time in sort of global IPOs, right? Versus maybe in a regular IPO where you can, in the US, where you can go a bit more sort of eyes closed and think that it's going to work out. And I think that's interesting because, as you're saying, you can actually deploy more size, but it also forces the people who invest then to have their own views in a way, to have their own views on pricing and upside for that company.
Yes. I mean, the traditional or the order for the traditional IPO is often I'll take 10% at market. There's not a lot of analysis necessarily built into that order when you call it into your, you know, to the bank that you're working with.
You're also relying a bit on the work of others because in a sense, the IPO is a clearing price. And I'm quite sure that actually the large investors do put quite a lot of effort into that research. And of course, then it prices where everybody's comfortable with it, both the investors and bankers and the company. So there is a certain degree of relying on the work of others, I guess, in the IPO process. On the retail side, as you said, the retail participation has come down over time in the US, but it's still very high compared to other regions. But it's come down, as you're saying, 50% of the Ford IPO went to retail in the 1990s, 2000s, and more like 15%. I'm not sure what the number is today, but 5 or 10% of the IPO. But even with that, the retail participation in the market is more like 20%. So I guess the direct listing also allows you to involve more retail if there is retail interest there. But is that something that your discussion with Spotify, Slack, et cetera, that they noticed that they did get more retail into their shareholders?
It's a good question. They wanted to. That was one of the objectives of their direct listings. I'm not sure I've seen any analysis, though, whether they did get them more retail or not, and if those retail investors stuck around. One common perception of retail investors is that they are buy and hold. And so if you're a company that's selling shares and you're looking for as many of your investors to stick around as long as possible, then you want as many retail investors as you can get. And so companies are looking for ways to cater to retail investors. You know, one of the things that Airbnb did, which I talk about a little bit in the book, is they sold some portion of their IPO to hosts. So Airbnb hosts through a directed share program. And the idea is there, you're sort of rewarding people that are already loyal to you and who are already familiar with your name and your brand and your story. And if they're loyal to you, then they're going to stick around for a long time. And so we are seeing one of the sort of side benefits of this wave of innovation that the direct listing kicked off is we are seeing a lot more directed share programs. Companies are looking for ways to sell shares to customers, clients, other consumers, and basically carve out some portion of their deal and so that it would go specifically to them. So that I think is sort of interesting. There are companies out there, there are technology platforms out there that are trying to make that as easy as possible. You know, Deliveroo in the UK did a traditional IPO, but they did a very big and very successful directed share program to their drivers, I believe. And so that sort of kicked off a lot of a momentum around that too. That's one thing that's exciting about this, I think, is getting more people involved in new companies, getting more investors, retail and institutional, involved in more companies.
There's many attractive features to the direct listing. One point, though, is the one about raising capital. And on the one hand, you see that it's probably more applicable to companies that are already profitable and don't really need to raise primary. At the same time, coming out of the last 2 years, we do expect more of the IPOing companies to actually be profitable now because they've focused a lot more on that. So that's maybe going to drive it. But what do you think is kind of necessary for the direct listing to be an effective IPO route for companies coming? And what do you think it takes to become more mainstream?
Yeah. So the big thing is you can't raise capital through direct listing, but the SEC now in the US has rules on the books for a primary direct listing that would allow companies to raise capital effectively at the price that the market sets. It makes the SEC very nervous because the price setting mechanism will be in the market is so in flux. And so they don't want companies to think they're going to sell 100 million shares at $25. You know, the market gets involved and all of a sudden they've got to sell those shares at like $15. Or $50, you know, that makes it very hard for companies to sort of predict how much money they're going to get in the door when they do this transaction, and companies don't like unpredictability. But that said, those rules are now on the books. And so we really need one company to work those rules out. At a very high level, they've been established, but there are still very small things that still need to be worked out with the SEC and with the exchanges, actually, about what that would look like and how it would work. So you really need a guinea pig, and you need somebody who doesn't really care how long it takes them to list their shares publicly, and who doesn't need the money quite as badly as other companies might that are going public and rushing towards an IPO. So, you know, 6-9 months ago, I knew there were a couple companies that had been kicking the tires. I haven't sort of checked in on that. And I haven't heard any names. But I think once you can see a company doing that, you know, it's basically like what Spotify did for the direct listing. You need another pioneer to say, here's what a primary direct listing looks like. Here's how we can raise capital. And I think once you can get that, you can get more companies trying it out, especially if it goes successfully.
I think as long as the capital need is not so large as potentially market cap, there's no reason it shouldn't work like the regular direct listings, because it's just, say, 5% of the company that's a bit more price insensitive maybe, but it's not so large that you really need to take a hefty discount on it. But yeah, it can definitely work.
And that'll be really interesting to watch.
Have you seen any other examples of sort of non-tech companies doing direct listings, or has it been really focused on the tech scene?
Yeah, so there have been, I think, 14 direct listings now. One of them was done by an insurance company. Another one was done by a cannabis company. I mean, both of those were pretty small companies. And so it's largely been pretty well-known tech companies. But there's no reason it can't be a mechanism that works for any company. You know, I think these early ones were basically, you know, we're in a tech-driven world and we know tech brands maybe better than we know oil and gas brands or industrial brands. And so it's easier for you to get a Spotify or a Warby Parker or a Slack or somebody like that going public through a direct listing, because some of the marketing onus that falls on companies is sort of done already. But if it becomes mainstream and you as a company can sort of figure out how you can market yourself to the subset of investors that you want to capture and to some retail, then I think potentially we could see more companies doing it.
Now, through the interviews for your book, you've heard inside stories from a lot of IPOs, and I really appreciated some of those stories, and especially the people behind them that I didn't know about. Which of those stories stuck the most with you?
I think a lot of the stories, you know, inside the room stories really stuck with me. I loved hearing about sort of how Unity Software, who we haven't talked about, but they didn't end up doing a direct listing, but I really learned quite a bit about what their interactions with their bankers were like that were super interesting, and some yelling, some screaming matches, some tense moments, but pretty interesting. And then, you know, we were talking about retail participation. I mean, one of the stories I love from sort of the history section of the book is Sam Adams Lager.
It's the first retail directed share program, right? But actually going out through the bottles.
Yeah, exactly. And like the first microbrew in the US in the mid-90s, you know, the founder decided he wanted to sell his shares to the people drinking his beer. And so he worked with the SEC and basically, like, for a month or two, just hung little advertisements on the beer bottles that he was selling in the grocery stores. And it said, like, if you want to buy some shares of this, call this number and get a prospectus. And that's very real world, tangible. And I just like, you know, that's an early innovation of just a founder saying, like, this current process doesn't work for me. I want to do it a different way. And let's figure out how we can do it. And from what I've heard, actually, many of the investors, or I don't know what percentage, but a lot of investors who bought in 1995 into that IPO still hold shares. So you talk about how retail is buy and hold. You're selling into this loyal customer base, and it can really work for companies.
I think the Sam Adams story is great. I'm just wondering if you would actually get away with it today. Great ideas. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to IPO Stories. In future episodes, we'll host CEOs, CFOs, advisors, and other participants in the IPO process to learn from their experience, like from Dakin today. If you'd like the show, please follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and share the show with people around you. If you have questions about the IPO process you'd like us to address with future guests, please get in touch at contact@ipostories.com and follow our LinkedIn account, Amundsen Investment Management.